started. How many of you play piano? Anybody? A couple of people. All right. Do we have any people that like to draw in here? Got some painters, artists. Okay. How did you learn to do it? Anybody care to say? Or are you still learning?
Practice.
Practice? So it takes a lot of practice, right? And you probably had, possibly, you had some type of, you know, foundational principles that you know you needed to start with, like playing piano. I don't play piano, but I know enough that you have to learn where key of C is and where the other keys are, right? If you're going to do much. And if you want to, you know, paint, you're going to have to learn some knowledge of how to mix colors, right? You know, if I mix this color and red and yellow, it's going to make, what's it going to make? Anybody tell me?
Green.
Green, orange. I don't know. I'm just throwing it out there that, you know, there's things like that. If you're going to learn some of those things, you're going to have to learn some foundational principles. And I'm here to say that I think the same is true with teaching. And so we're going to be looking at a book today called Seven Laws of Teaching. To give you some foundational principles in teaching, and hopefully it inspire you to read the book. I want to say thanks to Jonathan Erb. I don't know if any of you know him or not, but he has taught this class other places, and he kindly gave me a lot of information when I was preparing for this class. So I might quote the book sometimes without specifically saying so, and other times I will, you know, specifically tell you and read some quotes from the book. So, why would we study a book like this? Well, it's interesting to me that in our culture, we're well known for our quality cooking, good furniture, a lot of things like that, right? And we'll go to a lot of lengths to learn how to do those things, right? But somehow, we want you to be a school teacher. Good luck. Here's your classroom, here's your students. And we don't spend a ton of time. Now, thankfully, there's people that have a vision, and you're here today because somebody said, hey, we need to help some of these New Year teachers figure some things out. Give them some help so they're not just thrown in there like, here, sink or swim. And so I think it's a good thing. Why wouldn't we want to be good at teaching our children? Because it's a way of passing on the faith, right? And passing on our values to our children. So teaching is the communication of knowledge. Teaching is an art. Like every art, music, drawing, things like that, there's basic laws that govern it. And the more you observe and study those laws, the more skillful you will become. It doesn't mean that to be a teacher, you're just going to follow some dead laws. You're going to need some enthusiasm, too. But enthusiasm is not enough by itself. And you might can think of, you know, people that do things. Some people do something with a lot of enthusiasm, but the final product is, you know, maybe not exactly what they were hoping for. And then you might find the person who does super well, but there's just no enthusiasm. It's just totally deadpan the whole time, right? And you're like, well, are they even excited about what they're doing? Do they even care? Yeah, I mean, that's a wonderful job, but so we somehow have to blend the two. We have to blend enthusiasm, but also quality and, you know, really knowing how to do this. So our work, our teaching needs to be based on skill, needs to be motivated by skill, but we want to blend that together. And so this book is hopefully going to give us some help in that. I'm sorry. I forgot to give you one too. I missed you. I'm sorry. So I don't want these laws for you to feel like they're restrictive or that they're limiting. Think of them more as foundation blocks that you can lay to build on. You know, if you're going to build a house, you don't just, well, let's start building and see how this thing turns out. That's about how it's going to turn out, right? It'll look like you didn't know what you were doing. And so I want to give you some tools, some foundation blocks that you can start building on for your classroom. So there's seven basic foundation stones in this book. It was written by a man named John Milton Gregory. He was born in 1822, named after John Milton. And John Milton Gregory started teaching at 17. Got any 17-year-olds in here? No? You're all up. Anybody younger than 17? I assume probably not. So, but he started teaching at 17. At the age of 30, he became superintendent of a school in Detroit, Michigan. He was the founder of and contributor to the Michigan Journal of Education. At 36 years old, he was elected to a state superintendent position in the public schools in Michigan. And in 1863, he declined superintendency because he wanted to go work at Kalamazoo Michigan College because he wanted to spend more time teaching and less time doing administrative work. When he was 45 years old, he started the Illinois State University, and he served on many educational boards, wrote several books in his retirement, including this one in 1884. So that's just a little bit on the man behind the book. It was first published in 1884. In 1917, there were two professors at the University of Illinois, where John Milton Gregory helped to start. It's where he's actually buried. And they took his book and they cleaned it up in their minds. They took out most of the references to the Bible, most of the references to Bible truth, to make it more culturally acceptable. And the original version lay undiscovered for another 80 years. And I don't have any other details on why that happened, but 80 years later, the original manuscripts from John Milton Gregory were discovered, rediscovered, and Veritas Press took it and reprinted it in 2004. So the book that I'm holding up here is based on the original manuscripts. It has the references to the Bible and Bible truths mixed through it, as John Milton Gregory originally wrote it. Got any grammar police in here? All right. Language is not my favorite subject to teach, by the way. All right. So as we get into the seven laws of teaching in this book, let's think about some things going on in this class right now. How many different components do we have going on in this class? Can we name a few real quick? There's seven basic ones based on the seven laws here. So what are some components of this class?
Teacher.
There's a teacher.
Listeners.
There's listeners or students. Good. What else? Think of any others.
Environment.
Good. What else?
Content.
Language. Good. So, we have a common language. You're able to understand mostly what I say, at least when I speak properly. We've got the content, the lesson truth. We have the work that I've done beforehand to present the lesson. You have some work to do now, at least if you're going to be a nice audience, you're going to listen and hopefully learn something. And then last of all, we could have review. I could quiz you at the end of this class. I'm not planning to give you a quiz, but we could, right? And see whether you've learned anything. So going down across the laws on your sheet there, I'm going to touch on each of them. Where's my clock? Here we go. Try to keep it moving and get over these. You could say, this might lean a little more towards the philosophical side of teaching, a little bit of the kind of the, not so much the practical side, but a little bit more on the theory behind teaching. But I will throw a little practical in as well. So law number one simply says the teacher must know that which he would teach. He needs to be the one who knows the lesson or truth that's going to be taught. And that's pretty obvious, right? If you're going to go into your classroom, you better know what you're going to teach. Do you know everything? I don't. If you do, good for you. We can't really know everything. But the more we learn, the more we can connect and understand. Think about understanding Bible truth. If you simply take one verse out of the Bible, we can, depending on the verse, you can understand it. How do you come to understand that verse better? Somebody tell me. If you're struggling to understand a verse, what might you do to learn it, figure out what it's saying better?
Look up
meanings of the words. Start comparing it to other verses that use that same word, right? And you start pulling things together and connecting things. And the more you broaden that out, the more you can understand about it. And there's a lot of things in life like that, even in school. The more you learn the context and the broader truth behind it, the more you'll be able to understand. And hopefully the more you understand, the more inspiring it can become. Read a quote to you here that says, he must ever be a cold and lifeless teacher who only half knows the lessons he would teach. But he whose soul has caught fire from the truths which he carries glows with a contagious enthusiasm and unconsciously inspires his pupils with his own deep interest. And it might be a lesson that to you might not even be the most inspirational thing, but you can still learn about it and gain some inspiration so that when you get to class, it's not like, okay, do you know what 2 + 2 is? And the student's like, well, he doesn't even care, so why should I? So even in simple things, you know it well enough to become inspired about it. Don't just read the teacher's guide and go, oh, okay, I know how to teach that class. Work a problem. Make sure you know how to do it. Be able to work the problem on the board. Show the student. See if you can figure out a way to connect it for them. Study it, learn it. Is fake it till you make it a good idea? You might have heard that already. Well, just get in there and go. Fake it till you make it. Is that a good idea?
Probably not.
So I think it's better to just honestly admit to your students, I actually don't know. But let me see if I can find you an answer. Because now you've earned respect with them. If you fake it, they're going to catch on really quick. Students are not dummies. You're not going to fool them like we tend to think we are. So it's better to just admit if you don't know something and then see if you can learn it. Because now you've got an example to show them of how to learn. You can come back to them and they're like, hey, he actually cares. He took the time to figure that out and get me an answer. Don't be too proud to admit that you don't know or that you were wrong. Maybe they come back with an answer. Maybe you kind of faked it and they actually learned the truth about something and they come back. Well, then be willing to admit, hey, I was wrong. Thank you for finding that out. Look into it. Keep studying. Look for ways to connect to what the students already know and how to practically connect it to their world. Learn from others all you can. You don't have to discover everything on your own. There's so much at our fingertips that we can learn from. Read. Find an interest in learning something. If you don't enjoy reading, maybe you can listen to lectures or podcasts, or, you know, it all depends where your interests lie and what capabilities you have. But there's a lot of ways to learn, not just reading a book. There's a lot of other ways too. Law number two, the learner must attend with interest to the fact or truth to be learned. The learner is one who attends with interest. We learn better if we have an interest in it, right? Let's see. I don't know. What's an example? Boys, are you interested in learning how to cook? Some of you might, because some of us enjoy that. It can be sort of a stress reliever, but some of you, it's like, blank look. Why would I learn how to cook? You girls want to go learn how to build mini barns? It could be some of you that might enjoy that, but again, you know, I've got fairly blank looks over there. You know, if you're going to try to teach somebody something, hopefully they have some interest in it. Now, your job as a teacher is sometimes to get their interest. They might be like, I don't know that I need to learn this. We'll see if you can get their interest, because the learner needs to have interest in it if they're going to learn it well. Remember, you're not a fat dispenser. You're not just filling bags. You're not just pouring info into a container. If you don't get the mind engaged, it's like reading a page while your mind is in another world. You've never done that, have you? You ever read something and you're like, wait, what? We do that too often, especially with our Bibles, don't we? We have five senses that we can use to gain people's interest. Interest is going to vary with age and personality, so we got to keep that in mind as we're trying to gain the interest of people. We need to move from compelled interest to attracted interest. Your student does need to pay attention to you because you're the teacher and they're the student. I don't have a lot of control over you right now. If you all wanted to walk out, you could. In your classroom, your students don't walk out on you. You compel them to listen, right? That's your job as a teacher. But hopefully, we move them beyond the compelled interest to where they're actually like, hey, this is interesting. What? I wonder what we're going to learn next. Get them to go to beyond the I have to I get to. Learn what makes your students tick. What are their interests and aspirations? What catches their interest? Try to eliminate distractions before they come. Sometimes you have to focus on the distraction and then get back to work. You know, maybe the siren goes by on the road and, you know, every head's going to swivel, right? Well, be quiet for a second. Let them see if it's an ambulance or a fire truck or a police car. And then it's gone down the road and back to work. Or maybe there's, you know, a deer going across the yard or a stray dog or whatever it is. You know, and you might have to give it a second, a few seconds, and then come back to it. But you're going to have to get their interest. True enthusiasm is contagious. Your facial features, your hand motions, there's a lot of things that you can use to keep people's interest, right? Recognize the importance of good questions. If you lose the student's attention or interest, just stop teaching. If they're all looking at you blank, they're like, and you can tell they have no idea what, you might as well be speaking German. Don't keep on speaking. Stop, back up, figure out where you lost them, go back and find, get their interest back, and work away from that point. Sometimes you have to recognize they're overloaded. Till the end of this week, there's going to be a little bit of that. It's going to be enough. It's going to be time for you to just stop listening to people talk, because you're going to have had so much information, and you might be already even starting to feel that today, a little overwhelmed. Well, just take notes, write things down, come back to it later, because the same for your students. We're planting seeds, not plants. Just put those little things in their life. Law number three, the language used in teaching must be common to the teacher and the learner. It's a medium between the teacher and the learner. It needs to be common. We talked about that at the beginning of class. We're communicating here. I think for the most part, you're understanding what I'm saying. I don't speak another language, which is unfortunate, really. I should discipline myself and learn one, right? But if I was to launch off in Spanish, how many of you would understand what I was saying? All right, a few people that would. If I was to speak German, would anybody understand? Okay, so, you know, we could find multiple common languages here, at least between a few of you. When you're talking to your students, make sure you're speaking their language. You're like, I speak English, so do they. Yes, but remember, use terminology that they can understand. Words can have multiple meanings. They can have multiple shades of meanings. Depending on where you go teach, if it's across the country, a word might have a little different shade of meaning there, depending, you know, where you come from. You might use a word that makes sense to you, but your student has never heard that meaning of the word before. Words give us ideas. Words give us mental pictures. And if your student has no mental picture to go with the word, they might have a really hard time understanding what you're saying. And that's where the language has to be common, because language is so much more than words. It's the pictures. It's the gestures. It's the whole, you know, thing that it makes us think about. let's see here. So we need to speak in a way that students are comfortable and they're understanding and they're willing to ask questions. This quote has to do with that. But children do not ask explanations. Fear of the teacher or a sense of their own ignorance discourages them. And too often they're charged with stupidity or inattention when no amount of attention would have helped them to understand the unknown tongue. Sometimes maybe you're teaching something and you ask a question and the audience is sitting there, your students, and nobody speaks. And you're like, well, what's wrong with them? They know the answer. Well, maybe you lost them. Maybe the way you worded it, they have no idea what's going on. And so be careful about that, that you don't push them and they're actually scared to say anything because they don't know what to say. So make sure you stay connected with them. An example of this, how we use terms, this was a little while ago, but one of my four-year-old boys, he was talking about an iPhone. And he was using the term in a way, I don't remember exactly how it was, but it's like, I don't think he gets what an iPhone is. And so my wife held up her phone and was like, hey, you know, this is an iPhone. And you could tell by the look on his face that that was not what he was using the word for. It was a total disconnect between the real life object and what he was picturing in his mind when he was talking about an iPhone. So make sure that your language is common with your students and that even if it's a common term, that they understand. Now do stretch them. Teach them new words, but don't lose them. Use good figures of speech, but make sure they understand them. All right, ready for law number four. The truth to be taught must be learned through truth already known. We need to be able to explain it in terms that they know. Would somebody in here like to explain quantum theory to us, please? No? Can anybody tell me what quantum theory is? Define it at all? I can't either. I haven't studied quantum theory. But I could up here start talking and explaining to you quantum theory if I actually knew, and you might not even be able to understand what I was saying because you wouldn't have a clue what it is to begin with. And so to understand quantum theory, we would have to go back. It's something that Einstein studied, right? And it has to do with these deep scientific principles. And so you would have to go back and learn things leading up to it. We couldn't just jump in and explain it. So what you know leads you to what you don't know. And we have to be really careful to do that with our students. Find something familiar that they know and lead them from that to something new. And your teaching should go somewhere. Your students shouldn't feel like they're just sitting on a merry-go-round spinning, getting dizzy. We know that. We know that. Why do you keep saying it? And you need to keep going. Not too fast, but in steps where they can keep up with. Not too big, not too small. If you go too small, they're going to get bored and they're going to be looking out the window because, hey, we heard this all before. And if you go too fast, you'll totally lose them and they'll be like lost in the woods. And, well, that's a good looking tree, but I don't know where we're going besides around this tree. And, you know, they're lost. So we need that connectedness. And I think of it a little bit like this. You know, if you're standing here in the middle, and the more ways you can connect yourself to what you're learning, the more it'll make sense. And I just kind of think of arrows like this, that, you know, as you're standing there, the more information that you can pull in from different areas of life, the more it will help you understand what you're trying to learn. And so with your students, try to do that. Take them to what they know, and then take them on to the next step. If you lost them, again, back up and keep going. Another illustration of that would be hooks to hang things on. You know, we have hooks, we hang our jackets or whatever on them. If you have no hook to hang that information on, it just sort of falls and disappears. You have to have something to hang it on and connect it to. All right, law number 5. Excite and direct the self-activities of the learner and tell him nothing that he can learn himself. Teaching is arousing and using the pupil's mind to form it in a desired conception or thought. So this comes back a little bit, ties in a little bit with what we already said with Law 2, where the learner needs to be interested in what they're learning. But it's our job as teachers then to excite them. You know, when a child is little learning how to eat, we spoon feed them, right? You get some food on the spoon and you put it to their mouth. But your mom doesn't do that for you anymore. You outgrew that stage, right? And a child reaches a point where they don't even want that done to them anymore. But what do we tend to do as teachers? We pick up the spoon and we feed our student. And then we wonder why they can't find the answer for themselves, right? We have to excite in them the desire to learn and help them learn how to learn. If they can figure it out for themselves, that's way better than you just telling them. So I could go study quantum theory and come back with a lecture prepared to teach you. Or you could go learn it yourself, right? Now, I don't know if I excited you enough about quantum theory to make you go study it, but maybe I gave you at least enough that you'll be like, ah, I'm going to go look that up and see what it actually is. And we should be doing that with our students. We want them to learn to dig in and learn for themselves. We want to lead them to that aha moment where they're like, I know where you're going with this. You ever have a student do that? You're teaching and you're kind of leading them along and you see that one student or so in there. Yeah, they jump ahead of you. They figured out where you were going with it. Don't be intimidated by that. That's actually great because that means they're tracking with you and you're leading them somewhere. They see what's happening and they're going to retain it a lot better when they seem to learn it themselves. Maybe they didn't entirely discover it, but the way you led them along, they're discovering it, and it's not just, well, 2 + 2 = 4, program that in. You're not just programming facts, you're leading them along, and they're getting that joy of discovering something for themselves, which is really important in our world today that we do that. True teaching is not that which gives knowledge, but that which stimulates pupils to gain it. It may be said that he teaches best who teaches least, or better still, he teaches most whose pupils learn most without his teaching. You cannot make someone learn, can you? You can make them pay attention to you, but can you make them learn? I don't think you really can. You can coerce them into paying attention. You can coerce them into repeating things, but they're not really, really learning it. You can't make them intelligent, can you? Can you change the IQ of your students? No, you won't be able to do that. We want them to learn so that they can apply it in life and learn more things themselves. See, if all we do in school is fill them with facts, and all they do is absorb facts and repeat them back, When they get out of school, are they going to know what to do with those facts and what to do with other things that they want to learn? No, we've got to teach them how to look and how to discover things for themselves. We want them to find that joy, that they're smart enough to actually figure it out. You know, that student that thinks he can't do it, and you keep saying, well, it's right, you know, read in this column. And they finally realize, hey, I can find that answer. And you might have to help them narrow it down, but help them learn the fun of finding that answer. Again, we're not just putting plants there. We're stirring the soil. We're planting the seeds. We're trying to build on that native curiosity that children have, right? God puts it in children to be curious. And as adults, we should still be curious too. But I want to give this warning. Our world has a plethora of gadgets and things that drown our curiosity and stunt our growth. We have so many things that take our minds away, and children aren't inspired to just go out and dig in the dirt anymore, are they? We need more of that. Dirt's okay for children. They need to be creative. They need to use their brains. They don't just need to, you know, be stuck in a desk or behind a screen. And so let's do what we can as teachers to excite that learning in them, to make them want to go out and build things and, you know, cook things and all that kind of good stuff. We're not just entertaining or filling their minds. We want them to learn to ask questions and to search for answers. And remember, the only stupid question that they ask is the one that they never ask. We tend to like, you know, well, that was a dumb question. Well, sometimes students do ask some pretty dumb questions, and they're more of a challenge than anything. But we want questions to come in, and we don't want to have a classroom where they're scared to ask any questions. We want them to ask questions, because if they're asking, hopefully then we can guide them in asking maybe a better question. So let's excite them to learn and help them find knowledge and truth. Law number 6, the teacher must reproduce in his own mind the truth. Sorry, not the teacher. The learner must reproduce in his own mind the truth to be acquired. Learning is thinking into one's own understanding a new idea or truth. In this book, it would say that there are 5 levels or stages of learning. And this is going to vary where your students are at based on the age of your students. So the 5 stages of learning, first of all, you have memorization. Secondly, you have understanding. Thirdly, there's the translating it into their own words. Fourthly is finding the reason and, you know, why is it this way? And then the last way is the uses and applications of it. So you can think about teaching younger students. We do a lot of memorization, right? We teach 2 + 2 = 4. But we also try to move them from just the fact that they know 2 + 2 = 4 to understanding that, you know, 2 blocks + 2 more blocks actually makes 4 things, right? And we get them to visualize it, right? And so we not only do we just teach them that fact, we show them and help them understand. Well, then they can translate that in a sense into their own words, because then they can come over and they know, well, if I have 2 suckers and I have 2 more suckers, well, now I have 4 suckers. And so they've translated it into their own words, right? And you take that on into older students, you know, we want them to learn scientific facts. We want them to understand it. How do you know if they're getting it? Well, when they can say it back to you in their own words, then you know they've actually got that truth. Maybe you could think of it a little bit like this. Can you explain the simple message of salvation to somebody? Well, I hope you can, and you should be able to, because hopefully it's a reality in your own life. But you being able to translate it back from your own experience and your own understanding now proves that you should know what it's about. And so we don't just memorize, we don't just come to understand, we actually want them to be able to put it in their own words and help them to actually know why these things are what they are, and then how can they use it in real life. And that one's really, really important. You'll have this question come, well, why do I have to use this? Why am I going to need to know this in real life? Well, not always can you give an answer, well, this is where you're going to use it. But it's all about building that experience. And there are a lot of places in school where you can apply it to real life. So be on the lookout for that to help them apply it. We could say it this way as well. There's the stage of what does the lesson say word for word. Then there's, what does it mean? And then how can I express it in my own language? And then is the lesson true? And in what sense is it true? And why is it true? And then what's the good of it? How can we apply and use the knowledge that it gives us? And so we want to take students from just that simple memorization of facts on to being able to, again, learn and understand things for their own life. We want to guide their thinking. Value original thinking in your students. Maybe you have a student that comes and they think in an entirely different way than you, and that can be really frustrating. It used to be much more so for me. Like in math, I've had students that could come and, they knew how to do the problem, but they couldn't really explain to me how they did it, and they could do it mentally in a way that made no sense to me, because for me, math is something that's very analytical. You got this plus this and equals this, and that frustrated me. But I actually have come to kind of appreciate that, the fact that they can actually do it in their head. And they still need to learn how to do it, but there are people that don't think like me. That's a good thing, right? You want everybody to think like you? And so value original thinking, but we have to guide it into good channels. We want to be seekers of truth and lovers of truth, able to recognize falsehood. We don't want to raise a bunch of just sheep that all they do is baa and follow a leader. We want them to actually be able to think and recognize falsehood in life, right? Your high school students, you want them to be learning how to think through and take Bible truths and apply them to their lives, right? Because we want them to be adults that do that, right? I mean, high schoolers are basically adults, right? And so that's our goal, is to get them to reproduce the truth in their own minds. All right, law number 7. The completion, test, and confirmation of teaching must be made by reviews. The test and proof of teaching done, the finishing and fastening process must be a reviewing, rethinking, re-knowing, and reproducing of the knowledge taught. What is review for? Take up class time, right? What is review for? Did you like review when you were in school? So the basic point of review is to see if they've learned, right? It does two things. It sees whether the student has learned, and it sees whether you've taught, right? It checks on you. Because if they can't play it back to you, it's either because you failed to teach or they failed to learn. And maybe it's a combination of both, right? And so the point of review is to perfect the knowledge, to get it drilled in, to confirm it, and hopefully then to make things knowledgeable, their knowledge ready and useful. We want review to be more than just repetition. Now, some things are pretty much. I mean, how do you review math facts except for repetition, right? You just got to drill it. But there's a lot of other ways you can do review, especially when it comes to other classes. You can use questions. You can use applications. You can think up word problems to use in math class and give it to them. And that's a good way to review, to see if they're actually using what they're learning. Can they apply it? You can incorporate your review into the lesson, not just a standalone activity. You can start with review from the day before and then go into today's lesson. And not only are you reviewing, you're also using one of the other laws. Which law is it? Well, review for you. If you start a class with review and from there you move right into your new lesson, you're using what other law? You don't have to give me the number. Just put it in your own words. Exactly. You're starting from where they know, and you're reviewing, but you're kind of killing two birds with one stone, because you're reviewing, making sure they know, but you're also moving right in, and you're tying it right along into the next thing. And so review doesn't need to be a standalone. Okay, new lesson done, now review. Tie it all together. Don't skip the review in your lessons. It's there for a purpose. Now, I know we have to tweak assignments sometimes to make things possible and doable for the students, but review is more important than what I used to think. It's so easy to want to just skip the review, not take the time for it in class, but it's important because it drills it in. And going to what Aaron was talking about, you can make review play and make it fun. My students this past year, fourth grade students, loved it. Like in science or social studies, especially, is where I would use it. Reviewing for a quiz or a test, and they all stand. And then I go down the line, ask a question. If he gets it right, he gets to stay standing. If he gets it wrong, he has to sit down. If goes to the next person, and sometimes they all sit down till we get to the end of the line because they don't know the answer. And then, did I teach right? So you can do things like that. They also loved it when we would go to our church auditorium, and every time they got the answer correct, they got to take a big step forward. And you got to watch that, because then you got the ones who think they have to take a giant leap, and, you know, then they do the splits trying to take their steps, and, you know, so you kind of got to watch it. But you can take review and make it kind of fun like that. Make it into more of a game, and you know, rapid fire, and anyway, it keeps them engaged. So there's a couple of practical things for you. So I'm going to read one more quote, a little bit longer here from the end of the book, that hopefully can inspire you here. Just kind of reviews these points for you. So, I have now finished the discussion of the seven laws of teaching. If I have succeeded in my purpose, I have made to rise up and pass before the reader. First, the true teacher, richly laden with the lesson he desires to communicate, inspiring by the clear vision he has caught of the truth. Second, the true learner with attention fixed, an interest excited, eager to enter and possess the promised land of the unknown lying before him. Don't you wish all of your students had that idea coming into this school year? They're just so excited that it's a promised land to walk into, right? We'll paint the picture that it is. Third, the true medium of communication between these two, a language clear, simple, perfectly understood by both. Fourth, the true lesson, the knowledge to the pupil, the unknown standing next to his known and half revealed in its light. These four, the actors and machinery of the drama, have also been shown in action, giving fifth, the true teaching process, the teacher arousing and directing the self-activities of the pupil, like a chieftain leading his soldiers into battle. Sixth, the true learning process, the pupil reproducing in thought, thinking into his own mind step by step, first in mere outline and finally in full and finished conception, the lesson to be learned. And seventh, the true reviews, testing, correcting, completing, connecting, and fixing into permanence, power, and use the subject studied. In all this, there has been seen only the play of the great natural laws of mind and of truth, affecting and governing that complex process by which a human intelligence gains possession of any branch of knowledge. The study of these laws may not make of every reader a perfect teacher, but the laws themselves, when fully observed in use, will produce their effects with the same certainty that the chemical laws generate the compounds of chemical elements, or that the laws of life produce through the growth of the body. That makes it sound just wonderful, doesn't it, to be a teacher? And it is wonderful. And I want you to go into it with that kind of enthusiasm, you know, and that's the joy of being a first-time teacher. Hopefully you're just excited about it, and you go into it just 100% enthused, and your students will feed on that. And so hopefully you can lead them. You can be a successful teacher. Learn all you can, and most importantly, put God first as the most important part of the foundation, and then build on him using these laws. Thank you for your attention. I do have some of these books available. They're in the box over here, especially for you first-time teachers. There's some of you in here that might have it in your library already. I don't know if I have enough for one for everybody, but if you are a first-time teacher and you would like one of these books, please help yourself out of that box. Maybe we can put it right by the door. If there's not enough and you're a first-time teacher and you really, really want one, let me know and I will try to get you one. Thank you. You are dismissed.